Hi, and welcome back to the Leading Language and Literature Podcast with me, Chris Jordan. In this episode, I'm talking with Drew Perkins. Drew is director of Thought Stretches Education and host of the Thought Stretches Education podcast. I wanted to speak to Drew as I continue my exploration of what inquiry looks like in the classroom and particularly how it applies to English. Drew is an active advocate for implementing inquiry in a meaningful manner within education and has helped thousands of individual teachers to do so. We discuss the difference between inquiry, project-based, and other constructivist approaches to teaching, what inquiry is for and what it offers students that other approaches do not, how we know when to give students the level of autonomy they can handle, how we can best aid students in generating their own questions, what Drew means by order of operations and how it is practically applied, and finally, whether Drew thinks there's a difference between inquiry in elementary and middle school and a difference between subject disciplines. Thanks again to Drew for discussing inquiry approaches with his customary enthusiasm and expertise. If you want to be kept up to date on when educational chat like this happens, then be sure to subscribe to the podcast and or follow me on Twitter at ChrisJordanHK. Okay, then, Drew, I know this is kind of a topic that has been brought up on your own podcast a few times, and it's something that you have kind of discussed at length with a number of different people. But in terms of these kind of different constructivist approaches, which often and probably unfairly get lumped together more often than not, what would you say is the difference between the likes of inquiry, project-based learning, discovery-based learning? How do you draw the distinction?
Yeah, it's a really important question because I do think, to your point, it gets conflated quite a bit and frustratingly so, in my opinion, and certainly some of the researchers and advocates and evangelists of direct and explicit instruction have done that in writing. And I think that's a real problem because it isn't the same. Those things are not the same. So we want to make some important distinctions and think about what it is that we're trying to achieve as a desirable learning outcome, and then use the methods and approaches that I think are best geared towards that. So when I think about, I suppose, all of this, it's maybe best to think of it for me in terms of a spectrum. If you say on one end of the spectrum, you might have the most traditional, and that can, you know, often look like unproductive, a drill and kill, or somebody recently said to me, sit and spit. I hadn't heard that one before, but that is, you know, very traditional on one end. And somewhere on that end is direct and explicit instruction. Certainly, we don't want to do the same thing that people do with inquiry and strawman it and say that direct or explicit instruction, which are technically two different things, are lecture and drill and kill, sit and spit, and that kind of thing. And then if you move all the way to the other end, you get more towards these constructivist, progressive kinds of approaches that I think probably on the very far end, you would have something like free school, something where kids are, you know, directing all of their own learning, and the adults are some sort of just sort of guide there to help them, you know, almost like a chaperone in some sense. In most schools, that's certainly not appropriate. There's certainly some places where that works, and we don't want to say that that's necessarily a bad thing, but in most academic settings, that's not appropriate. And discovery learning is something closer to that, right? So discovery learning is where kids are meant to sort of find knowledge on their own. In a K-12 setting, here in the States, at least, we are not the same as university, whereas university, they're creating knowledge. In K-12, we're learning knowledge and other things. So in a discovery learning situation, I would characterize it by kids sort of really trying to figure things out on their own, generally pretty inefficient. And if efficiency is something that's important to you, then obviously discovery learning is a bad thing. If there are other things that are important to you, then discovery learning can have some value, but it certainly isn't efficient. When I think about inquiry teaching and learning and most academic settings and the way that it works best, it is a mix of guided instruction and guidance from an adult, a teacher, using their expertise and a variety of different methods. So that might include things like direct and or explicit instruction. And the idea that we are doing discovery learning in what I would call quality or robust inquiry teaching and learning, that I would say is a mischaracterization. But I think it's a valid criticism of inquiry teaching and learning constructivism that you have teachers that do sort of tend towards that in favor of what might seem, you know, appealing, might be more towards the idea of behavioral engagement, but sort of overlooking that cognitive engagement piece that is obviously very important if we're in search of and in pursuit of some serious academic outcomes. So, you know, you want to think about what are the ways intentionally in inquiry teaching and learning that you are setting up and planning for students to actually do real learning. Again, some of that might be scaffolded, direct and or explicit instruction. Some of it should be inquiry exercises and probably some of it collaborative activities, because you want to get to surface, deep, and transfer. If you want to use sort of Hattie's framework, then you want to use a variety of different approaches to get there. So then the question about project-based learning, and that's a tough one, because there are some people who talk about it differently than we talk about it in our work with schools. I think it can be a valid criticism of project-based learning, just like any sort of progressive constructivist inquiry kind of approach, insofar as that it's not very structured, that teachers sometimes think they're not supposed to be teaching. One of the pieces of our PBL model at Thought Stretchers is autonomy. And we really caution, say, look, we want to give students as much autonomy as they can handle and is productive for them. But that doesn't mean, because it's something that we value, that we turn that knob up to 11 if Spinal Tap fans, right? So you want to make sure that you are guiding their learning in ways that will help them be productive. And so project-based learning for us is really characterized by a big central feature, which is a really strong driving question with clarity on product, purpose, and audience. What are we creating? Why are we creating it? And for whom? What purpose is it serving for that audience? There's a purpose for the teacher, of course, that you want them to learn these things, but the purpose in that driving question is connected to the audience. And that's important, because then we develop that need to know list. What do we need to know and learn and be able to do in order to answer that driving question, which should be quite, you know, very well aligned with whatever learning outcomes, content standards, learning targets, whatever you want to call them. And those are the things then you connect your teaching to. And that's where that scaffolding comes in of, you know, maybe direct or explicit instruction, inquiry activities, collaborative activities that are getting aligned with that surface, deep, and transfer kind of piece. And so that sort of relationship, we sometimes call it pull teaching, of like, how do we pull that thinking from students and how do we give them the opportunity to identify what they need to know, sometimes with significant help and sometimes even some manipulation from the teacher as facilitator, so that they not only have that sort of need to know list as a roadmap, and the teacher does, but that they are gaining experience and modeling. They're seeing that modeling in terms of, how do I frame problems with questions? Because we certainly know that when students are in outside of academic settings, they're going to have to be problem solvers. And one of the best ways to be problem solvers is to be able to frame things as questions. So I want to go to university, or I want to go teach in an international school. You know, what are the questions I should be identifying and thinking about and answering in order to do it? Not just do it, but do it well. So to us, that project-based learning piece really features that relationship between the driving question and the need-to-know list as an inquiry feature. And then also for us, authentic audience, because we say, you know, if we're trying to create something for that audience, it opens up the inquiry process of, how do we know if our work is good? Well, we need to know who our audience is, what their needs are, how we meet those needs, how well we've met those needs, and you sort of have that iterative process. So Yeah, project-based learning features a lot of inquiry, also features other things, collaboration, and I think sometimes people get wrapped up in some of those other things that are great, right? They're working with adults, they're working outside of the school, and you know, all the things that certainly are good things. But at the end of the day, if you're doing project-based learning and you're not getting that inquiry process from the driving question to the need-to-know list and then connecting your teaching and the students are actually learning, if you get to the end of the project and they haven't learned the things you want them to learn, then you've got a real problem.
Yeah, it brings me on quite nicely to what I was going to ask next. But before I do that, like, I think that's like a real experience that I've had before, this idea of like the excitement or the the enthusiasm like the teacher feels at like giving them the autonomy and giving them choices and asking them, you know, go in this direction, go in that direction. And once you get to the end of the unit, you sort of feel like they did go in their own direction, but I should have followed up in so many more ways in terms of, like you say, sort of maybe not necessarily direct instruction, but you know, kind of feeding back on what they had so far and being able to sort of point them in the right direction and blah, blah, blah. So I think inquiry from the outside looking in seems so easy to do, depending on how, you know, you perceive it, but it's so difficult, like in practice. I suppose like any pedagogical approach worth its salt, it's like an incredibly tricky sort of thing to master. But for what it's worth, I do think that I've sort of flip-flopped in terms of when I graduated, it was very heavy on constructivism in the UK. Then it sort of, with the Educational Endowment Fund coming in, it all went very direct instruction and this kind of thing. But I bought a book. I'm an English teacher, a secondary English teacher. I bought a book last year. It's an amazing book in terms of like how to apply research, most of which is around direct instruction or explicit instruction to English. And the author kind of listed the three things that the book would be useful for. And it's like, you know, raising students' academic levels, increasing their life chances, and making sure they pass exams. You know, it probably wasn't in that order. Mm-hmm. But even then, I was like, something is missing there. Like, this isn't, and this is me speaking as a privileged person working with international school students. And I'm sure that teacher isn't in the same boat. And I'm not necessarily the audience he was going for. But to me, there's something lost there in the sense of like, yeah, all those three things are important, but I feel like the scope for more. And I think Guy Claxton's referred to it as like the third way, so to speak, that it's like you can have more than just those things. So my second question is like, in your opinion, your experience, what is inquiry actually for? Like, what does it offer students that other approaches do not?
Yeah, well, I think just to pick up where you left off there, because I think you raised some good points. And you know, one of the things that I get frustrated about is this sort of what seems like a monomaniacal sort of focus on things like efficiency and retrieval and long-term memory change. And, you know, then the follow-on are some of those things you mentioned, right? So these things like that are very real, and you know, how do we help students be successful as adults? Certainly one of those things, or some of those things, are those baseline kinds of not necessarily transformative and big picture and abstract kinds of things, right? Do they know how to read? Do they know how to do math? Do they have basic knowledge of the world, those kinds of things? And that's really, really important. And I think that inquiry advocates can sometimes overlook that, right? The idea that, they have Google in their pocket, they don't need to know that stuff. That's totally BS as far as I'm concerned, right? Like, certainly there are some things that we can learn, we can look up, right, that we don't have to have at our immediate disposal, but we should have, first of all, I think the idea of shared knowledge and sort of cultural shared knowledge, there's a real argument to be made there. And to your point of, that you made about the difficulty of doing inquiry teaching and doing it well, it is difficult. And there's a fair argument to be said that if we have to make a choice with our teaching force and what our students are getting, are they getting inquiry teaching and PBL and those kinds of things, or are they getting more direct and explicit instruction that's sort of traditional? I'm not sure that I wouldn't err on the side of the more traditional because it's ostensibly easier to do. I don't know if that's 100% true, but it certainly seems intuitively true. You can do those things poorly, right? But making sure that they have those basic skills and knowledge versus these sort of big picture transformative 21st century, you know, whatever those soft skills that people who are advocates for progressive education often talk about. So ideally we're giving them both or most of those, right? So it's not just limited to that idea of those basic things. So what is inquiry good for? Well, inquiry is good for, and it's kind of hard to pin down in some senses because it's not, I mean, what is inquiry teaching? Well, it's a lot of, it's a little bit more abstract. It's a little less easy to put your thumb on. It's, you know, as we think about it, the intentional pieces that I mentioned, right? So what are the structures that you can put in place? What are the actual things and exercises of, you know, whether it's a question formulation technique exercise or World Cafe or Socratic Seminar, those things that are intentionally planned. And maybe you are using big pictures, or I'm sorry, big questions to drive some of the units, whether it's project-based learning or not. You know, those are some intentional things. But then there's the intuitive pieces of a teacher who knows how to sort of artfully push in and pull back and really ask a good question here, or to let them think about something a little bit. So it's a little more difficult, I think, to put your thumb on than Rosenshine's 10 principles of instruction, right? Those are very sequential, boom, 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 right? And those outcomes are very easily quantifiable and measurable. So what are the things we want inquiry? Well, inquiry can help students wrestle with bigger picture abstractions and consolidate those pieces of knowledge from a variety of different places and put them together in ways that make sense of bigger picture things, and also helps them, you know, we talk, the direct and explicit instruction advocates often talk about long-term memory and remembering things. One of the things that we know about that is that the more ways you have, more connections you have between pieces of knowledge and things, and the more times you use it, the more likely you are to remember it, right? People in the States here were meant to memorize the 50 states and capitals, but they often can't remember all of them because they don't use them in any meaningful way. They use some of them. If it's their home state, they will remember that very generally, or, you know, very typically. So, you know, the inquiry process gives them opportunities to make different connections in ways that I think deepen the learning in important ways. It also, I think, can help with some intrinsic motivation because it is generally more sort of intellectually nourishing. It's sort of more intellectually seductive, right? Or it can be, isn't always necessarily, but certainly can be. Direct and explicit advocates would say that being successful at learning something is motivating, perhaps, but I don't know how sustainable that is. I don't know how grand that is in terms of being durable. And again, how long will they remember that? So, yeah, I mean, inquiry can do a lot of things, and it is a little less easy to quantify, but is more about the quality of the experience, I think. You know, what is it that you want out of your students? You want them to know and understand things, but also to do critical thinking with those things and to be able to ask the big questions. You know, is it, I did a podcast many years ago with a professor who worked in classical education. And of course, classical education, people would say, well, that's very traditional and certainly isn't inquiry and project-based learning. I think that's a misnomer. And we actually as we talked, there was significant overlap. And one of the things that he said, and I would totally resonate with, is he said, you know, what if instead we get to the end of a course and it isn't about what you remember or know, but do you know the questions that should be asked about in that sort of discipline or that academic area, which of course implies that you know and understand the things that are in that course. So it's a little bit bigger picture.
I completely agree with you in terms of like the intrinsic and like the personalization part of it. I do get to sort of the end of some units and I feel like I've carried them all the way through here. And if they make a mistake, they don't know why they've made a mistake. Or if they've succeeded, they don't really know why they've succeeded. They've just parroted is probably, you know, not, you know, it's a bit of a kind of pejorative term, but they basically have just parroted things that we've talked about collectively in class, and they've followed things because you're trying to get them over the line on an exam or something like that, you know, something where you kind of have to, you know, again, to be pejorative, you sell your soul a little bit and you're just like, right, we need to get through this because we've only got 7 weeks. Whereas if you've got a unit where it's something where they've had to do their own research, they've had to go in their own direction, they've had to kind of decide what kind of product they want at the end of it or what kind of, you know, iteration they want in terms of the different choices you've given them, you can have like such a more meaningful reflection at the end of those units because they'll hold their hands up and say, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have, you know, done that survey, or I should have done that interview in this way, or I shouldn't have wasted my time doing that. And I just feel like, I think, it's very, very hard for them to kind of get those experiences, and they are soft skills. And I'm not sure how well you can measure them or test them, to your point that you just mentioned then, in terms of showing proof. But it's kind of, you've got to be in the room listening to those conversations between, you know, year sevens, year eights, year nines, what have you.
There's some sort of a cumulative effect, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you say, well, you're teaching these sort of, again, soft skills, which in some ways is pejorative, right? It's a trigger word for some people. So, or a trigger phrase, you know, do you learn that do you gain that ability to ask those questions and be metacognitive and all of those things that we want students as adults to be and to do? Do you learn it in a very short amount of time? Well, you might learn a little bit, but, you know, it's sort of develop, and developmentally it starts to take a little bit more hold, and eventually over time, and sometimes even outside of after the academic setting, you know, I mean, I can reflect on my own time as a high school student, and I certainly was engaging in some of those things. I mean, I did, like, I don't know if you've ever heard of it here. We have a program called Future Problem Solving, and so it's a process of a group getting together and working on a sort of big problem, and there's a process. And, you know, honestly, when I was in the middle of doing that as a student, as a adolescent, as a teen, I don't think I really understood the big picture of all of the pieces and why some of these things were important, or, you know, really, I was just sort of almost going through the motions and the steps. But I would say that as an adult, those things now, it's like you know, you pull back a slingshot and all of a sudden you let go and it's like, it really, you know, oh wow, now it makes sense, right? Had I not done those things, you know, there's no counterfactual, but had I not done those things as an adult, would I have that ability the way that I do? I would intuitively say probably not. I would say that many adults don't have that ability. And, you know, that is something that I think is a real problem in a number of ways in today's world, is that we have lots of adults who they might know a lot of stuff, they might know a lot of things, but are they able to think critically and reflectively about all kinds of things? You know, anecdotally, my brother works in marketing and advertising. He says when he has worked with, you know, fresh employees out of college, university, that oftentimes the students who have gone through a more prestigious school they really struggle to sort of be self-started. They want to be told what to do. They can't think for themselves as some of the students who have gone through a less traditional method. Now, I don't know for sure, but my assumption is, my intuition is that those more traditional schools, those prestigious schools, are probably engaging less in the sort of inquiry approach. And I may be wrong about that. Whereas the students on a little more non-traditional path haven't, and they've had to figure some things out. They've had to sort of improvise and be a little bit more creative. And those are the employees, he says, that tend to flourish more, especially at the beginning, because they are able to be faced with a problem or project they've never been able to do or had to do before. And they won't say, "I don't know how to do this. Tell me how to do this." They'll say, "I'll see if I can figure it out."
I definitely, again, it seems kind of tempting to just completely agree with that, because I can imagine there probably are correlation, causation things and stuff like that. But even within my recent experience, I can think of the youngest year levels that I teach and how just from being very naive about certain research methods, like I was talking about before, surveys, interviews, observations, they couldn't believe that they created this survey, made it look lovely, sent it out. They couldn't believe that no one wanted to reply to it. They were like just kind of so offended and affronted. And they were like, "Well, why wouldn't they?" It would just take them 2 or 3 minutes. And we had to have a conversation with a number of groups about why that might be. And same with kind of they were marching around the school hoping to take photos of this, that, and the other in order to take. And certain members of staff were like, "No, that's not going to be okay. We don't give our consent." And I just don't see how that is that really specific to English? Not really. There's quite a lot of interdisciplinary kind of crossover there. So it's not the business of English to be teaching those things. But I don't see how you would have those experiences if you were just teaching so-called pure direct instruction in every single subject. So I think there's a lot of truth in that anecdote regarding your brother's workplace. But to that point, my third question for you is, how do we know when to give students the level of autonomy they can handle? So I'm assuming you work with maybe elementary schools and secondary schools, middle schools, whatever. That can be something that's quite hard to gauge, how much autonomy, how do we know when and the extent to which the students can handle these freedoms that we give them in an inquiry based unit?
Yeah, well, I mean, autonomy obviously extends outside of inquiry, and whether we should be giving them sort of less guided instruction, that kind of thing, but it's certainly related. And we talk about this in our project-based learning workshops and certainly some in our inquiry workshops and services. So one of the graphics that we use is sort of talks about, or it shows down in the right-hand corner, it has PBL. And if you imagine a XY axis, so the complexity of the work that you're asking them to do, and then the amount of sort of guidance or autonomy you might give them being on the other axis. So many people think about project-based learning saying, well, you're giving them complex tasks and minimal guidance, which is sort of discovery learning, right? And we have a big red X, that's a terrible idea, right? So traditional instruction, the most traditional, is giving them more simple tasks and a lot more guidance and instruction, really sort of less autonomy. And so as we think about the shift along the, through a project or through a lesson or whatever it might be, you want to think about the complexity of the task, right? So Hattie will talk about cognitive complexity for students and their prior academic achievement. So how do you gauge that? How do you perceive that? How do you understand those things? Some of that can be difficult to do because you may not know your students. You may not have data on them. To the extent that you can know that, you want to then gear the work that you're doing and the amount of guidance that you're doing, whether it's inquiry or not, based on that, right? How much can they handle, right? And if it's more complex, you're going to need to give them more guidance and more support, more scaffolding. And I think that's, again, true outside of inquiry, but certainly true inside inquiry. I have two daughters. They're teenagers now. But when they were younger, I would not have given them a sharp knife and asked them to cut a tomato, for example, you know, if they were 4 years old. I would have given them a butter knife and asked them to cut butter, because that's much less sort of complex, you know, relatively. And so would I need to guide them as much if I wanted them to, if I, you know, for some reason wanted to really build their skill in cutting tomatoes, which seems a little silly, but, you know, just to extend the example, if I really wanted them to do that, I could scaffold it and I could support them. I could hold their hand and, you know, show them and pull your other hand back, or, you know, the kinds of things that you would do as an adult, and scaffold that, that I wouldn't need to do if they were cutting butter or bread or something like that. And so I think the same thing is true of instruction, and that term productive struggle gets really put down quite a bit by the direct and explicit instruction advocates. They say there's no such thing, or some versions of that, and it's clearly not true. We have, you know, zone of proximal development, and I think they would agree too, and it's just a sort of rhetorical warfare device in some ways, right? We don't want kids to struggle too much because they get frustrated and shut down. We don't want it to be too easy. So you want to figure out that sort of sweet spot where they are challenged but not overly challenged. And with inquiry, we want to say, you know, first of all, if we're thinking about using inquiry, is the lesson a good fit for inquiry? So that's a really important question. So is it that we're really just trying to build surface knowledge? Well, if that's the case, then inquiry may not be, or certainly probably is not, the most effective or efficient way to do that. We would want to really sort of do more direct and explicit instruction. So then you say, well, then how much inquiry experience do they have? And again, this kind of gets to your question about the autonomy. If they don't have much experience with inquiry, if they don't know how to ask good questions and they haven't practiced that, then you're going to need to really give them more guidance and more structure and more support, less autonomy. You know, we do the question formulation technique. If you're familiar with that, it's a question focus, which is a prompt, usually like a statement or a picture or something like that, and ask students and adults, depending on the setting, to generate questions. And sometimes, you know, you do that with kids who haven't had much experience with inquiry, and they look at you like you're an alien. Like, what do you mean? I don't understand what to do. And sometimes adults do too. So, you know, what's the level of autonomy they can handle? Can I just say, here's your question focus, generate questions? They may struggle. So you're going to have to step in a little bit and give them more guidance and less autonomy. And then again, what's the ultimate goal of my lesson? What am I trying to get at? That alignment, right? So again, talking about Hattie's teaching with intent. What is my intent here? What do I want them to come away with? And sometimes efficiency is really important. And so if that's the case, then inquiry is probably not the best way to do that. Lots of autonomy is probably not the best way to do that, because it's not going to be terribly efficient. But sometimes efficiency is not the main goal. So giving them more autonomy and letting them flounder a little bit might actually be a good way to proceed. Again, to figuring out what your academic outcome is that you're after.
Yeah, that completely makes sense to me. And it kind of is quite a nice, like, neat segue into this idea of generating their own questions. Like, my main question about it, because this is something that's relatively unknown to me, I don't have much experience with regard to getting students to generate their own questions. So when you're doing that, are the questions disciplinary focused? Are they self-reflections, or are they more kind of transferable topics, like big, broad concepts? Like, when we're posing these questions, what's the nature of them?
It just depends, I think. There's all kinds of different questions, right? I mean, if we just say, well, what are the need to know questions? They're specific to whatever, you know, project-based learning experience, for example, that we might need to know. If they are bigger picture, sort of essential questions kinds of things, those are a bit different in nature. I think also, you know, again, trying to get students to grow their ability to understand questions, understand the power of questions, the different kinds of questions, the ways you can use questions to get where you're going and what you need. I mean, all of those things are really important. Just, you know, clarifying questions. Can I ask a clarifying question? Does it make sense to ask a clarifying question? What's the difference between an open-ended question and a closed-ended question? And when would I use one over the other? And I mean, really, there's so many ways to think about that inquiry process. I want my daughters to be able to, again, sort of problem solve and frame things as what are the important questions I need to be asking. So, you know, when I pick my daughters up from school, I don't anymore because one of them drives, but when I would, I would ask that typical question of, you know, how was your day? And they'd say, you know, good, bad, or otherwise. And I'd say, why? Well, essentially, what's the evidence for that, right? So they had to think a little bit more. Of course, they'd roll their eyes and, oh, Dad, you know, come on. But, you know, like if you're saying you had a good day, but you can't tell me why, then how do you know it's good? And, you know, the way that perhaps they've been around me enough, for better or for worse, they tend to ask lots of questions. And one of the examples I use, and this is several years ago now, but I took a picture of it and use it sometimes in our work. My youngest at one point was really into making slime, if you know what that is, right?
Yeah. So
little kids making slime, right? And it, I don't know if they're still doing it, probably are. Little kids making different versions of slime and selling them, right? And so she wanted to make have a slime shop. And so I said, okay, so you want to open up a slime shop on Etsy or something like that? And I said, well, how do we do that? Well, let's use a question to think about this, right? So her driving question was, how do we start a successful slime shop? And successful is a really important word there. We want to make sure there's a quality sort of leverage of quality, right? Because we could say, how do we start a slime shop? That doesn't imply that it's doing anything good or effective or, you know, in this case, successful. So what are those things that would make it successful? And that's an inquiry process, a critical thinking process. Mm. And just in a very short amount of time, she came up with a set of questions. You know, what website should we use? How to take pictures of the slime and that are, you know, attractive or, you know, marketable, those kinds of things. How do we ship these? What are the prices? Who's our audience? How do we package them? You know, and a pretty good starting list. And, you know, she didn't continue. She decided maybe it was too much work and didn't really want a slime shop after all, which is a problem especially with little kids that can be a problem with inquiry and what they sort of following what kids want to learn. That can be a problem because they're fickle, certainly in many ways. Right. But, you know, my point being that she was able to come up with, and I helped her a little bit, but not very much. She was able to come up with a really, I think, functional, at least starting point of questions that you would need to figure out and would be then well on her way. And if I were teaching that as a project, right, I would say, all right, what website should we use? Well, today here, let's look at some of the websites. Let's evaluate them. Let's think about what would be markers of quality. And so you would connect your teaching to that. And it does strike me as really interesting. You know, the direct and explicit instruction folks say they've got to have all this knowledge. And I think that's certainly true, but at some point you're going to get out in the real world, the quote unquote real world, the non-school world, and you are not going to have people providing you direct and explicit instruction on things, right? You're going to be an adult and you're going to have a problem or going to need to figure something out. And you maybe could go to YouTube or something, but even then you're going to have to figure out what are the things I should be searching for, right? I've got to figure out how to solve this problem. And if you never learn how to do that, and all you're learning is how to know things, well, then why would we expect that they'd be able to be good problem solvers?
I think, yeah, like as you're saying this, I'm sort of thinking practically about like when this would happen in a sequence of learning and this kind of thing. But even as you say it, like I do this already. There are moments when, of course, you do pose opportunities for like open-ended questions, or like they may reflect on their own practice and what do I still need to get better at? What am I proud of? You know, where have I come from in this unit in terms of like, what were my skills in this area like before? What are they like now? And et cetera, et cetera. And I do think it's always interesting to kind of compare and contrast the little year sevens with the year 13. So the bottom of middle school all the way up to the top of high school. And the type of, I've got like a literature class at the moment who are sort of direct in their sort of like questions of me, whether it's about the structure of an essay, whether it's about my interpretation of a text, whether it's about whatever. Like they are very direct in just like, is that really the best way to do it? Is it really this? Is it really that? And it's kind of, it's hard for me to see whether that is because it's floating on a sea of lots of knowledge and therefore confidence, or whether they've kind of, you know, they might have done like Model United Nations or debate or something like that, which has brought them out of their skins and this kind of thing. So it's hard to tell where that particular kind of ability to do that, to be so like direct in questioning themselves and or the teacher in the process. But I feel like it's probably like a combination of all those things, right? It's probably a combination of being confident in the subject, but also having opportunities inside and outside of the class to question the best way to do it and be involved in kind of projects where it is just them and three other people of a similar age trying to, you know, work things out and do projects and win competitions. So there might be some students who never do Model United Nations and never do debate and never do these competitions that you obviously try and suggest they do. So maybe in the classroom, I think, yeah, I can see why it could be and probably should be a priority to build in like moments for, well, you've got to work this out. Like realistically, you've gone in this particular direction with this. What do you need to do now to, as you say, appeal to this audience? What does this audience care about? Where are you going to find out what the principal cares about or what the vice principal cares about, et cetera, et cetera? So, yeah, that makes total sense to me. Another thing in terms of like something you've talked about in the podcast with other guests is, you know, when you're debating the direct instruction thing and an inquiry thing, is like something that you referred to as like the order of operations. I think about this on a daily basis if we're talking about the same thing, but what do you mean by this, and like how do you practically apply it when we're talking about a project or a unit?
Yeah, I think generally when I'm referring to that order of operations, it's you know, the idea of I guess the assertion that I think is true is that kids can't think deeply or ask, you know, really great questions about things they know little about. And I think that's generally true. I mean, they might get lucky from time to time or who knows, but in a general sense, you know, if you don't know much about something, you don't know enough to know what you should be asking and that kind of thing. But in lots of example, lots of times you'll see teachers, they'll say, well, I'm going to sort of front load all of this knowledge, right? They're going to teach it. And so if you say, well, I'm going to start at the bottom of Bloom's taxonomy, if we're okay with using that as a sort of general framework, I'm going to teach that knowledge and maybe the understanding and say, all right, now that they know that stuff and maybe even understand it, now I'm going to ask them to create something to demonstrate their learning or, you know, for whatever reason I want to have them do that. And so the order of operations is what if we, instead of starting with students at the bottom with knowledge and understanding, you start with students at the top, which is create of Bloom's taxonomy, and ask them with a driving question to create something. So how can we create, design, develop, whatever that verb is, product, purpose, and audience, keeping those things in mind, and then say, all right, what do we need to know? Right? Let's identify those things. Those are your learning targets, outcomes, whatever you want to call them. But they show up in the need to know list. And again, if you have, you know, 10 learning targets in this project and they don't show up on your need to know list, then you've got a problem. But assuming we are getting those things up there, then we, of course, teach them. So they do need to know those, and they get that teaching and knowledge inside of the project and through the project as it's needed. And then they use it and apply it and do all of the critical thinking pieces that you would do, you would hope to do in any sort of project. So, you know, the idea that you start with students at the bottom is, I think, it's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, it's not like you're hurting kids, but to me, there's an opportunity cost, and it's really not much of a cost if you do this. And people say, talk about efficiency. Well, we don't have time to do that. Well, maybe, maybe not, but it really doesn't take a tremendous amount of time to go through this process of, here's our driving question. What do we need to know in order to answer it? You might do a QFT, question formulation technique. You might do some things to generate those questions, and you'll come back to them through the project. Maybe add some as you're going along because you hadn't realized you need to know those things. But the opportunity cost of not doing that, in my estimation, is that they don't get the opportunity to learn how to frame things as problems. So if you say we're going to do that process, then carry on through the project and do the teaching as you would, the scaffolding, you know, again, direct explicit instruction being part of that, inquiry exercises, collaborative activities, scaffolding, assessment, doing all the things good teachers do. They're getting all of that, plus they're getting the opportunity to learn how to generate questions that they'll need to know. They'll need that skill as an adult. So when we talk about the phases of project-based learning, the first phase is the planning phase, right? And this is before students enter in. And I want to be clear that, because it can sound like, well, wait, you don't know going into a project when you start with students what the, you know, the knowledge and understanding is. Well, that's not true, right? So the first phase is that as a teacher, I'm identifying, what do I want my students to learn and know and think about as they're going through this project? And then once I bring the students in, we're starting them with a driving question at create and identifying those things as need to knows. And then we're into the project. So, you know, I'll give you an example. When my daughter, my oldest daughter was in fifth grade, her teacher asked me to come in and help her with a project. And so we did a project. It was a fifth grade math. One of the big pieces of content was learning how to multiply decimals. And so we did a project where they had to create a tipping guide for a local restaurant. So we asked them, how can we create a tipping guide for, you know, hometown pizza or something like that? So we did that and said, well, what are the things we need to know? There's a blog piece that we have that shows, you know, some of the evidence of this. Sorry, my daughter, speaking of that daughter who is now a high school junior is texting me. The need to know list, one of the things was we need to know how to multiply decimals, right? And so when we are in the middle of the project, as the order of operations go along, we need to know how to multiply decimals today. And, you know, we did it over several days and they practiced, they did worksheets, we did explicit instruction. We showed them how to do it. Practicing multiplying decimals, and that's part of the process. So I don't know if that's helpful in terms of contextualizing and explaining it.
No, 100%. I think something which it brings me onto my last question in a moment, but before I go to it, I do think one of the problems we've got is that I think different subjects. I think inquiry means has to mean different things. I just think like the nature of the content in different subjects just means that the type of inquiry or the type of projects that you can do just alters ever so slightly. And I think one big thing that I agree with, and it's called a lot of different things by a lot of different people, but I do believe in that big provocation at the beginning of the unit. I think the first lesson is like your shot window into like, look how much work like me as a teacher or we as a department have gone into thinking of a topic that is, you know, engaging and relevant and something that you can find yourself in, you know, in terms of your individuality. It should be a topic that you can go home and discuss with your parents over dinner and stuff like that. So it might be, you know, why are there so many, I'm sure it's the same in the States, but Marvel is an enormous business in like Hong Kong and China. It's like Avengers and Spider-Man and all that. What about all those other, not superheroes, but what about all those other kind of heroes, mythical heroes that might be gone in 100 years because of globalization and stuff like that? So that gives them an opportunity to go off and kind of inquire into what's a particular kind of mythical hero from my culture that no one else has heard of, maybe I haven't even heard of, blah, 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 blah. And I think what has to live alongside one another is that personal kind of inquiry, personal research, and that kind of dips in and out of the classroom. You might ask students to do a pit stop and say, right, let's amass all the research we've done so far and show it to each other. And it lives alongside that direct instruction. Like any grammar that I'm teaching or any technique that I'm teaching it in the context of, you know, when we produce this thing at the end to keep this mythical hero alive for the next generation or blah, 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 blah. This is how it works in that context. And I think those two things kind of have to live, like side by side all the way through. Now, if it's like, wow, these guys really aren't getting it, we need to push the brake on the personal research and I need to do a better job of instructing, you obviously have to have that leeway in terms of, you know, the manipulation of whatever. But I just feel like, like once you get to that final product, there's clear evidence in terms of the skills that I have given them, as the expert in the room. But there's also a lot of them coming into it, which I haven't given them free rein on that. If they say, oh, you know, I want to do the Incredible Hulk, I'm obviously going to push back on that and say, no, come on, that's not really, you know, if you're struggling to find an example, let's think about what questions do we need to ask in order to find that different direction. But I think in terms of that brings me on to the final question, really, which is like, is it hard to define inquiry and is it hard to sort of for schools to harness inquiry, because there's a difference between inquiry in elementary school and middle school and high school, and even to complicate it further, between different subject disciplines. Like, have you ever found that to be the case? And what kind of conversations have you had around that?
It's an interesting question, and I don't know that I've been asked that question before. So when we think about the development of kids through, you know, early years into middle school, preteen, adolescent, all those kinds of things, certainly they have a developmental curve, and the work that they're doing becomes more abstract, and the bigger questions tend to be, or I guess maybe more complex questions become more appropriate. Certainly some big questions that little kids can and probably should wrestle with and think about, because there's value in that. And I think similarly, there's some that with subject area, because some things are much more sort of hard data, and like a math course, right? A math course is very generally quantifiable, and honestly, I think that lots of the direct and explicit instruction advocates tend to be talking about those kinds of courses when they're advocating for remembering things. And you know, as a side note, you know, like little kids learning how to read, that's a really important skill and ability, obviously. And they should not be doing inquiry constructivist learning with reading instruction. And so there's certainly an appropriateness level there. But as they matriculate and go through into middle school and high school years, and on, those questions that they should be pondering, I think are definitely more complex, and they're likely to ask more questions based on what, you know, I would say beautiful questions, get more questions, and, you know, it's sort of a more iterative process and refining that skill, right? Their thinking skills are different from elementary to, you know, high school students. I taught middle school and then I taught high school. There's a very distinct difference in what they are able to process and think about, and certainly things that they know. And when you have more knowledge, then you, of course, can ask more questions and you have more things to bring into that conversation. So, yeah, it certainly makes lots of sense that there are different kinds of questions, and inquiry plays a bit of a different role as they go from young ages to older ages, but then in subject areas too. You know, you think about a high school humanities course, or I taught psychology and AP psychology. I mean, the questions there are magnificently beautiful, right? Mm. And you're not likely to be spending time with, you know, first graders on big concepts like you might see in Shakespeare or, you know, things like that, right? Those complex questions, they're not quite ready to handle. And so the nature of the questions, and similarly, you know, if you're in a AP psychology class or a regular psychology class, as I was teaching both, the kinds of questions there versus what you might get in a biology class, for example, which is a bit more certainly of a hard science, or a, you know, calculus or something like that, are certainly different. And to that effect, the sort of math and science folks tend to, especially math, tend to struggle in ideating math project-based learning examples. Yeah. They tend to really struggle to see it contextual in the real world outside of academic settings, partly, I think, because it is so sort of linear and facts and knowledge and that kind of thing, and less about these big questions, right? You know, we don't wonder whether this equals this. We figure it out, and either it does or it doesn't. Interestingly, the folks who teach math and then do project-based learning at a high level have tended to be, in my experience, people who have been outside, they've come to math teaching from outside of that. And so they've used math in ways that seem apparent to them, where math teachers, I think, tend to have, they have been taught how to teach math, and it doesn't necessarily lend itself to being able to to sort of get those questions and connect to outside of the sort of academic settings.
Yeah, I feel like the difference between sort of inquiry and maths is the classic example compared with something like, yeah, inquiry in the humanities or English or something like that, because it seems, and it can go one of two ways, because in English you can set up an inquiry and it's just too big, as you said, like it's too kind of adventurous in terms of like, okay, we have water depletion in certain areas of the world, how are we going to solve this situation? That's you know, an issue that the World Health Organization is struggling with. It's not necessarily something that a year eight student can realistically be expected to understand. But then similarly, with math, like I've heard examples of how like teachers are desperately trying to find real world examples to teach maths through, and it's just that some concepts in maths are purely abstract. It's kind of you're learning it for the love of learning it, and I think one theme that's kind of come out of this conversation, it's such a nice kind of thing to happen, is like, it's just the nuance of understanding when inquiry is appropriate, when directing instructions appropriate, and understanding that they kind of feed off each other as opposed to being polar opposites. And I think the IB, which I know that, you know, not every school is an IB school, but the IB kind of principles into practice that every IB school gets given, it's like schools just need to be clear about what they're fixed about and what they're flexible about. They don't mandate which is which. They just say, you've got to have a conversation, whether it's as a department, heads of department, management, whatever, and just say, this is what we believe a unit should have. And this is like our kind of, model of progressional sequencing in the curriculum and blah, blah, blah. Like, you can't kind of realistically hope for a silver bullet in terms of perfecting inquiry and or perfecting direct instruction. It obviously just doesn't exist. So I think I'm all for nuance, and I think I'm all for kind of the complexity that comes with both of those kind of approaches, and finding like the sweet spot in the middle is obviously what makes the job challenging, but like obviously worthwhile as well. But that brings me to the end of kind of my questions, Drew. Thank you like so much for giving up your time to have a chat with me today. It is genuinely quite hard to get hold of people who have really in-depth insight of like inquiry-based teaching and are passionate about it. I've spoken to yourself, I've spoken to Julie Stern in the past about like conceptual based teaching. I've spoken to Trevor McKenzie and stuff, and like it is really nice to have the balance of conversation. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you for all your excellent output that you've got on Twitter and the podcast and everything.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to talk about this stuff, and we try to with our work try to get into the complexity and nuance. And when we talk about things on the podcast, it is about getting into the complexity and nuance and getting away from these binaries of this is the right way, that's the right way, those kinds of things, and saying, well, what's it right for? And then let's think about how we do that well. How do we balance those things? So whether it's on our podcast, our work, our website is wegrowteachers.com. And if anybody's interested, they can go there. It has all of our workshops and services, but it has lots of blog pieces, most of them written by me. So there's inquiry and PBL. There's also some things about direct and explicit instruction. You'll see something on cognitive load theory and Rosenshine's instruction principles and those things. Then I'll also mention, if folks are interested, our Thought Structures community. So that is a community that we've built that is at thoughtstructures.org. And those folks, if you're interested, you can go there. And where the meaning of that is to provide a place to have some conversations. We've got events and online discussions, some of them about inquiry, some of them about reading instruction, things like that, and sort of a social media kind of platform. So folks, if you're interested, jump over to there, thoughtstretchers.org.
I'll be sure to, link everything in the notes below as well. But once again, Drew, thank you very much.
Thank you.